Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has held talks with visiting Indonesian President-elect Prabowo Subianto in Beijing. Iran's ambassador to Syria has vowed responses after a suspected Israeli strike flattened Iran's consulate in Damascus, killing 7 people. The US and the UK have agreed to cooperate on artificial intelligence safety. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. Chinese President Xi Jinping has pledged to deepen cooperation with Indonesia and work together to build a closer China-ASEAN community of a shared future. President Xi Jinping held talks with visiting Indonesian President-elect Prabowo Subianto, who chose China as the first country to visit following his election. The Chinese leader said China is willing to maintain close exchanges with Indonesia and enhance strategic alignment for development. Prabowo said the new Indonesian government aims to achieve more results in the bilateral relationship in various fields such as economy, trade, and poverty alleviation. Sun Ye has more.
Chinese President Xi Jinping said that China views the China-Indonesia relations with a strategic and long-term perspective and is willing to deepen all-around strategic cooperation with Indonesia and bring more benefits to people of both countries. The Chinese president said China is willing to work closely with Indonesia on many fronts, and that President-elect Prabowo said he's glad he had chosen China to visit first after winning the election. He affirmed that China is a strong partner for Indonesia. He cited Chinese enterprises' active participation in Indonesia's development and said that he is in full support of closer ties with China.
So here was a report. Now, for more on this, I earlier talked to Rong Ying. He is Senior Research Fellow with Chinese Institute of International Studies. What does it tell us that Prabowo Subianto made China the destination for his first trip abroad since his election?
I think the visit by President-elect of Indonesia, Prabowo Subianto, which made China his first trip, is certainly very much significant, both in terms of the bilateral relationship and also in terms of regional peace and stability and for the world at large. China and Indonesia are both major developing countries, and their relationship certainly, I think, are very much important for the two sides bilaterally. But more importantly, I think that over the past, thanks to the joint efforts of the two sides, the relationship has set up an example of the two sides, how to promote the relationship and also work together to address the common issues, common challenges, and also for promoting developing countries, major developing countries, unity and solidarity. Last but not least, I believe that the meetings that we have had so far during the visit by President-elect Prabowo has strongly indicated that the two sides are committed to continue this process, the relationship, but more importantly, I think to deepen and broaden the relationship in a way that they have been worked together. That is very much important, because after all, we have a new government, we're going to have a new government, new president, and certainly there are new changes taking place in the region and beyond.
Mm. Well, during the meeting, Xi Jinping recalled the rapidly developing and fruitful bilateral ties over the past decade under the guidance of the two heads of state. He also emphasized that both sides have made the Jakarta-Bandung high-speed rail an exemplar of high-quality bilateral cooperation. Now, in specifics, Dr. Rong Ying, what have been achieved in the China-Indonesia relationship in the past decade or so?
That's a great question. I think over the past decade, with the sort of joint efforts, and indeed, I think the nurtured by the personal efforts of the two leaders, President Xi certainly, and from the Indonesia side, from President Joko Widodo, they have established a relationship under the framework of what we call comprehensive strategic partnership. And recently, I think in 2022, the two sides have also upgraded the relationship community of shared future between the two sides. That framework, that relationship are both visionary and also practical in terms of the, I mean, which set the not only direction, but also formulate plans of action to implement. And in short, I think the past 10 years, the past decades have seen that the relationship has been upgraded. The more importantly, concrete sort of efforts and steps have been made, both in terms of political engagement, economic and practical cooperation, people-to-people interactions, and equally important, the two sides have agreed to work together on the issues I would call the maritime issues. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are also specific mega projects, for example, the high-speed railway, the Jakarta-Bandung high-speed railway, definitely the kind of flagship project. But there are other sort of efforts, other cooperation, again, are very much important, but in terms of the synergy of our coordination between the two sides, the Chinese side on the BRI, the other side, I mean, Indonesia side, is their development strategy for themselves, global maritime fulcrum. Mm. So indeed, the relationship has a very solid foundation and also has a very visionary sort of plan.
Well, during the meeting, Xi Jinping said in the future, the two sides should work together to become a pace setter for South-South cooperation. He also said the two should promote the Bandung spirit of solidarity, friendship, and cooperation. I mean, in terms of cooperation and development experiences for the Global South, what do you think the China-Indonesia relationship can provide?
This is an area where the bilateral is significant sort of importance, both in terms of South-South cooperation or cooperation between developing countries, and also for regional and global sort of importance. We know both China is the largest developing country. Indonesia is also one of the major developing countries. And the two sides in the past, I'm talking about after they achieved their independence, have been working together to promote the common causes of developing countries. And we're talking about this year, the 70th anniversary of the five principles of peaceful coexistence. So there's a long tradition, great history, and a kind of a strong sense of solidarity in terms of promoting South-South cooperation. But more importantly, as they are celebrating, commemorating the past achievement, past 10 years of cooperation has continued that process, and also, I think, set an example or set the pace for the future, I mean, future cooperation, which now I think even more important. We're talking about cooperation among developing countries. We're talking about the importance of Global South. We're talking about the need for China and countries like Indonesia to work together to show, to demonstrate, I think, to showcase that developing country working together can make a difference, can lead, play an example for not only promoting the bilateralism, but also, I think, the common cause and aspiration, implementing aspiration of developed countries.
Xi Jinping said China is ready to work with Indonesia to uphold ASEAN unity and centrality, maintain an open and inclusive regional architecture, and build a closer China-ASEAN community with a shared future. Now, what's the role of Indonesia in the ASEAN mechanism, and how should China and Indonesia work with each other to strengthen ties in the region?
Indonesia is the largest country in ASEAN, and it is also a very important country in terms of ASEAN regional integration. China working together with Indonesia, it has also very much implications or impact for China and ASEAN cooperation. And we remember, I think China has, over the past years, working with ASEAN as a whole, again, for the visionary concept of building a community of shared vision between China and ASEAN. And for that, I think, again, the two sides have agreed and committed to build five homes related to political, economic, cultural, and other related. And the very fact that ASEAN is very much agreed or is regarded as organization that plays a central role in terms of promoting regional integration, regional architecture. So in the sense that the region as a whole will continue to not only continue to enjoy peace and stability, but also will play a role in bringing together the other major countries' interaction. This is very much important. And China and Indonesia had always been working together to play that role. Last but not least, I think China and ASEAN working together would also help China and some ASEAN countries to address some of the differences that have been arising in the interaction.
That was Dr. Rong Ying, Senior Research Fellow with the China Institute of International Studies. Coming up, Iran's ambassador to Syria has vowed responses after a suspected Israeli strike flattened Iran's consulate in Damascus. This is World Today. Stay with us.
Hello, my name is Alessandro Golombievsk-Teixeira. I'm a professor of public policy and management at Tsinghua University in Beijing. I am a great listener of The World Today. In my opinion, The World Today is one of the best China radio programs. In The World Today, we can get the best news and analysis in what is happening now in the world. So please, come to join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Iran's ambassador to Syria has vowed responses after a suspected Israeli strike flattened Iran's consulate in the Syrian capital and killed seven people. Hossein Akbari says the action has undermined international law.
All Syrians know this is the consular office of the Iranian embassy. Israel's action has undermined all standards of international law. It committed crimes against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. Besides, it also committed crimes against the Lebanese people, Syrian people, and the Palestinian people in the West Bank.
Iranian media says a senior commander in the Revolutionary Guards Corps was among those killed, and Tehran believes he was a target of the attack. The Syrian foreign minister called the airstrike unjustified. Israel has declined to comment on the incident. Ahsan Kivani has more from Iran.
Iran's ambassador to Syria says the consular building next to the embassy was hit by six Israeli missiles as well as F-35 fighter jets. This is not the first time Iranian military advisors are targeted in Syria by Israel, but a direct attack on Iran's diplomatic mission is unprecedented. After the attack, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Israel would be responsible for the consequences of this action. The minister said Since Switzerland represents the U.S. interests in Iran, Tehran immediately summoned the Swiss ambassador, and an important message was sent to Washington, as the U.S. is the main supporter of Israel, according to Iran's foreign ministry. The ministry says Tehran will later decide how to punish Israel. Iran's foreign ministry says this attack is a gross violation of international regulations, especially the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. The spokesperson of Iran's foreign ministry expects this action to be condemned in the strongest terms by the international community and the United Nations, and necessary action should be taken against the aggressor.
Ehsan Kevani with the latest from Iran. China has condemned the attack on Iran's diplomatic missions in Damascus. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says Syria's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity should be respected. A spokesperson says China opposes any action that will escalate tensions in the Middle East. Now, for more on this, we're joined by Dr. Wang Jin, associate professor at Northwest University in Xi'an, China. Thank you, Dr. Wang. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Now, the airstrike on this Iran consulate in Damascus is widely attributed to Israel already. How serious, Dr. Wang, is this development in the ongoing crisis situation in the Middle East?
I think if that Israel was really responsible for this attack, it would become a very, very negative news for the regional peace and stability. Given that that during the past months, we have already witnessed that Israel launched several attacks against the targets inside Syria and Lebanon, especially against the targets with the close ties with Iran, the military and the intelligence establishments. Mm-hmm. So that would mean the very, very direct provocation of Iran and Syria. And also it is a very direct violation of international laws and Syrians' own national sovereignty. So I think that is why it will bring uncertainties to the region again, given that it will provoke the anger of both Syrian and the Iranians. Mm-hmm. And also it will create more potential and more possibilities of the retaliation actions from Iran and Syria. Given the fact that the war in Gaza is still going on, I think it will make Middle East a more dangerous region with more unrest and crisis in the future.
I don't want to speculate, but Dr. Wang, do you have an estimate about, you know, the possible action that could be taken by Tehran?
I think Iran will do something, of course, because given that the anger is growing up in Tehran, so they have to do something. But I think on the retaliation, if the Iran has retaliation efforts, I think it would be concentrated on two sides, but both politically and diplomatically. And politically, I think Iran will mobilize the protests and demonstration against Iran's attacks, against Israel's attacks, and to show Iranians' anger and dissatisfaction and calling for the unity at home. Mm-hmm. And also they might organize, for example, military exercises and show up the new military weapons to the world to show that Iran has the capability and determination to safeguard their own national interests and their own national sovereignty. And on the other hand, I think diplomatically it would become the very important channel that Iran will call for the United Nations Security Council and other international organizations and the mechanism to condemn Israel's attacks against Iran's the diplomatic targets in Damascus. But given that I don't think Iran has the willingness to further expand and escalate the tension in the Middle East, I think Iran will maintain rational and restraint. But if more attacks, I mean, from Israel against the Iranian targets in the Middle East emerge in the future, I don't think that Iran's patience and Iran's rationale would be maintained. So that is why I think the international community should intervene to persuade Israel of stopping or the suspending such military action.
Mm. Well, Dr. Wang, as you have said, the fighting between Israel and Hamas is still going on. Will this airstrike on the Iranian diplomatic mission in Damascus have direct impact on the fighting?
I think, of course, it will have the very negatively, which will negatively influence the relations between Israel and Hamas, because we know that the dialogue is mediated by Qatar in Doha.
Mm-hmm.
So they hope to reach the very temporary ceasefire for the hostage exchanges. But the problem is that if the tension grows, given the very close connections between Iran and Hamas, it might weaken the Hamas willingness to reach the deals or make concessions to Israel. And it also will weaken the Israeli own the willingness to reach the temporary the ceasefire with Hamas. So, and meanwhile, we know that there were some military action groups in this region, for example, Hezbollah from Lebanon, the Houthi from Yemen.
Mm.
They hope that the Hamas to maintain assertive against the Israeli military action in the Gaza Strip. So I don't think it is a very good news. That is why I think I don't think it is very good news for the relations between Israel and Hamas the Israeli airstrikes against the targets, diplomatic targets in Tehran, and given that it will provoke the anger of Iran and provoke the anger of Syria, and also it will provoke the direct, a very strong anger of the groups with the close connections with Tehran.
Mm. Well, we have already reported about China's reaction to the incident. I mean, what kind of international pressure will be put on Israel at the moment? And Dr. Wang, how do you think Israel will handle that?
I think very great pressure will be imposed on Israel, because actually, as we repeatedly stressed, that Israeli action is the very direct was a very direct violation of international law and the very direct violation of other countries' national sovereignty. It should be banned, and it should not be it should not be encouraged. So that is why I think the international pressure will be there. And also, we have to know that there was the NGO from the Western countries with the volunteers from Australia and other Western countries.
Yeah, the World Central Kitchen Charity. They said
that
8 workers have been killed by Israeli airstrikes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So I think that all of this pressure will be combined together and make Israeli internationally more isolated and more, I think that their circumstances more negatively. But I don't think it will directly change Israeli military actions in the Gaza Strip, because Israeli is inside at home, that the right wing, the ultra right wing, they are still dominant. The Israeli public opinion, although they were different opinion, but they are still dominant the Israeli social opinion, and that is why I think Israel will continue this military action. Although we hope that this would not happen, but unfortunately, I don't think that this international pressure together will change Israeli behaviors, and I think Israel will continue their actions against the international pressure.
Mm. Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to shut down news network Al Jazeera following the passage Monday of a sweeping law allowing the government to ban foreign networks perceived as posing a threat to Israel's national security. Dr. Wang, how do you see this move?
I think it's a very direct move. On the one hand, a decision was made by Benjamin Netanyahu, who led the wartime cabinet, because now it is the wartime. Inside Israel. And also we know that this decision was supported by Israeli Knesset, Israeli parliament.
Right.
So it is, if we look at the numbers of the votes, I mean, majority of the seats in the parliament, they strongly supported. So that is why I say that inside Israel, although there were different opinions, there was the opposition, there were demonstrations against the war to continue, but the opinion, a social opinion, a majority of the social opinion still supported the war to going on, still support the war to continue to so-called eliminate all the networks of the Hamas in the Gaza Strip and to eliminate the threat. So that would be the bad news.
Thank you, Dr. Wang Jing. We appreciate your time and insight. Dr. Wang Jin, associate professor at Northwest University in Xi'an, China. Coming up, US and the UK have agreed to work with each other on AI safety. This is World Today. We'll be right back after a short break.
I am Dan Wang, Chief Economist of Hang Seng Bank China. The World Today is a real fun program. You will hear interesting people discussing global trend, economic event, what's happening in and outside of China. So, friends around the world, hope you can join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The US and UK have agreed to cooperate on artificial intelligence safety. US Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo and British Technology Secretary Michel Danilon signed an agreement in Washington, D.C. on Monday. The agreement will see the two governments collaborate on methods for testing AI models and assessing the risks they pose. It represents the first bilateral agreement on AI safety in the world. Now, for more details, Zhao Ying joins us in the studio. Thank you, Zhao Ying, for joining us again.
Great to be here.
Now, the two countries are the first to formally cooperate on how to test and assess risks from emerging AI models. Why are they working together on this?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. Both the US and UK are home to some of the world's leading AI research and development, especially if we look at the world's leading AI companies. Many of them, like Google and OpenAI, are based in the US. So the UK believes that the US expertise is crucial for understanding the risks posed by AI and for holding these companies accountable to safety commitments. Mm-hmm. And by working together, the two countries can pool their knowledge and resources to develop more comprehensive and effective AI safety tests. And notably, the agreement will enable the UK's new AI Safety Institute, which was set up in November, and its US equivalent, which is yet to begin its work, to exchange expertise through secondments of researchers from both countries. And as we know, the next generation of AI models is expected to be significantly more powerful than the current ones. And we don't yet fully understand the capabilities of these new models, and the potential risks they pose could be significant. So I think by working together now, the US and the UK can develop safety measures before these new models are widely deployed. Mm. And more importantly, AI advancements can have global impacts because a dangerous AI model developed anywhere could potentially affect everyone. So by collaboration, the US and UK can establish a framework for AI safety that other countries can probably also adopt, mm-hmm. so as to promote a more unified approach to managing these risks. Mm-hmm. And this unified approach would be more effective than a patchwork of regulations across different countries.
Mm. Now, exactly what are some of the potential risks associated with emerging AI models, and why is there a sense of urgency to address these problems?
Well, there's a wide range of risks because, many complex AI models are like black boxes. Mm-hmm. Like we can see the outputs they produce, but not necessarily how they arrive at those results. So this lack of transparency makes it difficult to identify and address potential problems and can erode trust in AI system. And from the ethical perspective, AI models are trained on data sets created by humans, and these data sets can reflect our biases as well. Mm. And also, some malicious actors could potentially exploit vulnerabilities in AI models to launch cyber attacks, manipulate data, or even disrupt critical infrastructure. And on socioeconomic front, automation powered by AI is likely to displace some of the jobs, mm. which raises concerns about unemployment. And some even worry about the potential for high advanced AI to become uncontrollable and even pose an existential threat to our humanity. Mm-hmm. Like Elon Musk said recently that he estimates a 10% to 20% chance that AI could destroy humanity, although he believes the potential benefits outweigh the risks. And he didn't mention how he calculated the risk, but some experts say he is a bit too conservative and the risk is much higher. Mm. So I think the more powerful AI becomes, the more important it is to develop safeguards to prevent such a scenario.
Mm, indeed. Now, the US and UK are framing this partnership as a way to improve AI safety. However, Zhao Ying, could it also potentially be used to restrict a competition from other countries like China?
Well, I think that is a reasonable concern because nowadays national security is often used by the US and its allies to justify restrictions on tech companies from other countries. And this partnership might also be used in a similar way to potentially hinder China or other countries' AI development under the guise of safety concerns in order to create an unfair advantage for US and UK companies. But I think maybe we can be cautiously optimistic about this partnership because the focus seems to be on developing testing methodologies for AI safety, which could be beneficial for everyone because if these tests are objective, they could be applied to AI models regardless of their origin. And this would promote a level playing field based on safety instead of on nationality.
Mm.
And also both of the US and the UK have emphasized the importance of transparency and collaboration with other countries. And this suggests they are open to including other players in this conversation to move towards a global standards rather than a US-UK dominated approach.
Mm.
So I think it is important to keep an eye on how the partnership develops and will these testing methodologies be truly objective? Will other countries be fairly included? And I think it's also important to encourage transparency from all parties involved.
Mm, indeed. Now, what are major tech companies like Google and OpenAI saying about these measures? Are they on board?
Well, there are signs that major tech companies like Google and OpenAI are becoming more involved with AI safety measures. Like both Google and OpenAI, they are participating in this new formed US-UK partnership on AI safety. And by collaborating on these tests, companies can contribute to creating a more robust framework for AI safety.
Mm-hmm.
And also earlier this year, Google, OpenAI, and Anthropic PBC, they all published plans outlining how safety tests being designed will inform their future product development strategies. And also OpenAI, Google's DeepMind, Microsoft, and Meta are among the tech groups that signed voluntary commitments to open up their latest generative AI models for review by Britain's AI Safety Institute. And so I think this transparency is crucial for identifying and addressing potential risks. However, there are also reasons to be cautious because, as we know, tech companies are profit-driven and there is a potential tension between safety and the speed of innovation, and companies might prioritize the latter in a competitive market. So I think it's still an evolving landscape, and that's exactly why collaboration between governments, academia, and the tech industry is crucial.
Mm. We're talking about that. In your opinion, what are some of the biggest hurdles to achieving global cooperation on AI safety?
Well, I think it's perhaps the lack of trust, because building trust between nations is essential for effective collaboration. But, you know, there are some concerns about things like intellectual property theft or the potential for military applications of AI.
Mm-hmm.
And these could make countries wary of sharing resources and expertise. And besides, countries have different levels of AI development. Like developed nations might be more invested in safety measures, while developing nations might be more focused on catching up technologically. So this gap could also make it difficult to find common ground on safety regulations. So I think it's important to support developing countries in building their own AI safety expertise to create a more level playing field and encourage broader participation in global efforts. While I think that achieving global cooperation won't be easy, but it is an essential step to ensure this technology is used for the benefit of all humanity.
Very complicated issue, but also very interesting development. Thank you, Zhao Ying. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us.
Hello, I am Dr. Digby James Wren, a political analyst and international relations scholar specializing in China area studies. World Today offers unmatched in-depth perspectives on China's politics, economics, business, technology, and society. World Today's team of reporters and contributors provides valuable information from all of the world's major economies. I hope you can join me on World Today for the very best insights and news from China, on China, and help to build a better understanding of China's role in the world today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. A survey conducted by Japan's central bank reveals that business sentiment among major non-manufacturing companies in Japan has reached a three-decade high in the first quarter of 2024. Sentiment improved for retailers, property developers, construction firms, and transportation services. Meanwhile, the rosy mood was somewhat offset by the souring sentiment for big manufacturers for the first time in four quarters. So what's the current state of the Japanese economy? What is the key that will allow the central bank to raise interest rates again? For more on this, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Ian Liang, professor of economics, Willamette University.
So, Yan, the optimism in Japan's service sector climbed to a more than 30-year high in the first quarter, a central bank survey showed. So what are some of the main factors behind it?
Right. So the optimism really comes from the service sector. So these are some of the results from the Japanese central bank's survey, the so-called Tanken survey. So what they have found is the service sector, the sentiment, the business sentiment has elevated to a 33-year high. And this is largely reflected by the return of tourism, both domestic and also international tourism. So as we know, because of the pandemic, Japan has lost some of these tourism revenues, but now it gradually comes back. And because of the Japanese yen has been weak in the last 2-3 years, that also helped to bring back international travelers. So with the tourism boom, it also provided a lot of opportunities for transportation, hospitalities, and other related industries. So you're seeing the service sector is doing very well. And so that, I think, is the reason why there's so much optimism. And of course, the service, the manufacturing sector, on the other hand, is not doing very well. The sentiment has dipped down. This is the first time in the year. But again, I think that is still, not as strong as the uplifting sort of sentiment in the service sector. So that's why you have a general optimism in the economy.
And what do you think are some of the challenges for Japan's economy right now?
Right. So I think there are still very fragile sort of recovery in some sense in the Japanese economy, even though, as we just mentioned, that service sector is doing better. But the manufacturing sector, especially in terms of the automobile industries, there are some concerns about, the production cost in terms of the global demand. So there are some concerns on the manufacturing sector. And also there is the concern about labor shortages. This has been an ongoing issue that because the worry is that if you have labor shortages, that's going to push the wages to continue to rise. And as we know, the Japanese labor union just got one of the largest wage increase, over more than 5% of increase in their wage contracts. So there is the concern that the labor shortages, the rising costs of wage costs are going to continue to push up inflation, and that would then prompt more monetary tightening. And so all of this could in some ways, reduce the economic dynamism in terms of corporate profits, because that has been really doing well for the corporate sector in Japan. And of course, the consumers are in a way not catching up because, as we just mentioned, the wage just start to increase and inflation has been high. So that really reduced their consumer demand. So I think in that sense, the Japanese economy is still in a pretty delicate, pretty fragile state. And a lot depends on, you know, some of the reforms, if they're going to proceed, and also in terms of, you know, how the wage, the cost, and also the weak Japanese yen. So all of this would factor into the future trends of the near trend of the Japanese economy.
Mm. And Japan's central bank raised the interest rates above zero for the first time in 17 years, just the last month. So why did Japan maintain the negative interest rates for such a long time? And what have prompted the shift in its monetary policy?
Right. So as we know that the Japanese economy has been stagnating since the burst of the real estate bubble. And so that's why their monetary policy has been easing for a long time. And on top of that, they're also hoping that if they have, you know, ease monetary policy, that would also help to weaken in some sense their currency, and that would help them to boost their exports and in a way sort of export out of the deflationary economy. But now things have changed because their inflation has started to rise, and it's more than the central bank's inflation rate target of 2%. So they started to realize that, you know, with the wage costs growing and with the inflation rate, especially when you look at the food price, for example, that has been going up quite strongly, more than 2,000 different food items has increased the price in Japan in April. So with all this pressure, I think the Japanese central bank start to see if they need to reverse their ultra easing sort of monetary policy. So now they're thinking to, well, they did raise the interest rate, you know, from the negative 0.1% to now 0.1% in the positive territory. And of course, it depends how the market is going to react. Mm-hmm. And that would then determine what the next step would be. Some economists argue the central bank should at least lead to raise the interest rate twice more for this year. Mm-hmm. But there are also others argue that because the business sentiment, especially in the manufacturing sector, is still weak, too fast and too drastic increase in interest rates could in some ways really, you know, suppress the consumer and also business investment demand. So I think they would walk a very cautious path in terms of what to do next for their interest rate policies.
Mm. And for the monetary policy change, how will this impact people spending and borrowing? And what are the benefits and drawbacks for the Japanese businesses?
Right. I think that's a great question. I think, like I said, there are many different forces, and some of these are in a way offsetting each other. So one example is when we see this large wage growth, that would supposedly, you know, help to boost consumer demand, right? Once your nominal wage catch up with inflation rate and leave some real wage growth, that would really help to boost consumer demand. And we are seeing that in some ways that, you know, the service sector, as we mentioned, the inbound tourism, even domestic tourism has been growing. But on the other hand, when you have high borrowing cost, that would then also, in a way, undermine the consumer spending, right? Especially with big ticket items that rely on consumer credit, that would, in some sense, make consumers think twice. And for business, I think that is even more of the of a factor. When the interest rate is low, then businesses are more willing to invest. But again, in Japan, I think corporate sector is hoarding a lot of the cash. So it's not that they don't have, you know, enough funds to invest. But rather because of weak domestic demand, the expected sort of profits are not high enough for these businesses to invest. So in that sense, I don't think raising interest rate would to a great extent undermine business investment. I think what really matters is if this kinds of interest rate increase would in some ways actually as indication that the economy is doing well and consumers are willing to spend, wage would going to continue to grow, and that would actually incentivize businesses to invest more because they see better domestic demand, more profits prospect. And so that would be the positive outcome. But again, I think it remains to be seen. And one last very important factor, I think, has to do with Japanese currency. As we know, you know, previously, because of the large interest rate differentials between the US dollar and Japanese yen, that's what has caused Japanese yen to depreciate by over 30% in the last 2 years. But now, if Japanese government, the central bank, has started rates and also prompt market expectations about a continuous rate increase, then that may in some ways strengthen the Japanese yen. And so that, on the one hand, would help, again, the Japanese consumers' demand. And on the other hand, for some of the import-dependent industries, they will start to see, better, in terms of the business costs and in terms of their profits. So I think it remains to be seen with all these different factors, right, that work in different directions, what would be the net result.
Yan Liang, Professor of Economics at Willamette University. This is World Today. Stay with us.
Welcome. I'm Elaf Ellard, economics professor and member of the Data Science and AI Center at New York University, Shanghai. On the World Today program, you can find in-depth and impartial insight, as well as critical commentary on key trends in the Chinese economy, financial technology, business, and blockchain. To prepare for the world tomorrow, join me on World Today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Adults over 18 in Germany are now allowed to carry 25 grams of dried cannabis and cultivate up to 3 marijuana plants at home. Germany has now become the third European Union country to legalize cannabis for personal use after Malta and Luxembourg. The German government argued that legalization would undermine criminal trade in the drug and guard against harmful impurities. The government also said this could free up the police to pursue more serious crimes while providing protection against use by under-18s. For more on this, we're joined by Helga Zeppler-Rusch, founder of the Schiller Institute, a Germany-based political and economic think tank. Thank you, Helga, for joining us again. Now, Helga, tell us, how significant is this new development for the German society? Is it a big topic in Berlin?
Yes, it is. And I think it is very negative because it is part of the cultural paradigm, which is being changed, more and more liberal values, more and more everything is allowed. And even the health minister, Lauterbach, who used to be against it, because as a medical doctor, he was well aware of the negative impact on the cognitive powers of people, he is now in favor of it. So I think it's definitely a sign of the decay and collapse of the German state, really, because, you know, it impacts negatively the ability to think. It is part of, an effort to make the population more docile because, you know, it distracts them from really important issues by furthering escapism. And I think there are a lot of political as well as economic motives behind it, but all of them, in my view, are completely negative. It is also proven that the argument that this will dry out the black market and make the drugs more clean is proven completely wrong, because if you look at other cases where this legalization was done, like in Colorado in the United States or in the Netherlands, the black market exploded after the legalization because it just increased the interest, it made the users younger and younger, and the legal part of this enterprise could not be not sufficient for the demand. So in reality, the drug market grew by large numbers and the casualties grew. So I think, you know, it's definitely something which we pay a big price for.
We already talked about what why the German government has supported this and their argumentation on this issue. What about the points that are being made against the legalization? I understand the main concern will be on young people, right?
Yes, young people who normally have no, you know, I mean, young people need to develop first criteria of judgment and most young people, teenagers, are famous of not having that yet, which is normal, you know, that's a phenomenon of youth. So if you expose younger and younger people to this, it's overall extremely destructive for their character formation. And we should not forget that, you know, there is always, you know, there is the immediate so-called on-the-surface issue. Mm. But historically, you know, it is a fact that the various intelligence services of the British and also in the United States and probably elsewhere, they were making experiments by, you know, studying what is the effect of on the population. And after all, this was one of the motives behind the opium wars against China in the 19th century, where, you know, basically China suffered incredible losses as a result of the opium wars, which were designed to weaken China at the time. And I don't think there are any other motives behind those who are promoting the drugs against Germany and other countries.
Well, Helga, will this development in Germany have impact on other European countries?
Mm. Well, I think it will be polarized because, you know, there are some countries who are unfortunately, you know, in the same kind of grip like Germany is right now. Germany has lost about all of its sovereignty, which is a real shame. And there are several countries who probably will go in the same direction. However, if you look at the world at large, you know, the countries of Asia, China, Russia, but also some African countries, and even some European countries like Hungary and maybe Slovakia, maybe some others, they recognize the political impact and the intention of this legalization. And therefore, I think hopefully it will strengthen their resistance against it. But for example, people in Africa, you know, who have been victimized by many things by the colonial powers over the centuries, they are becoming extremely critical against certain things which are being pushed by the West as being detrimental to their own interest. So, you know, I think that we will see, unfortunately, an increase in addiction, drug death, and generally, you know, the collapse of morality, because if you don't have the strength to resist these abusive drugs, you know, it makes you also susceptible for all kinds of other things.
Well, thank you, Helga, for talking to us on this issue. That was Helga Zeppler-Rusch. She's founder of the Schiller Institute, a Germany-based political and economic think tank. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. A quick recap of the headlines. Chinese President Xi Jinping has held talks with visiting Indonesian president-elect Prabowo Subianto in Beijing. Iran's ambassador to Syria has vowed responses after suspected Israeli strike flattened Iran's consulate in Damascus, killing 7 people. The US and the UK have agreed to cooperate on artificial intelligence safety. Well, to listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. For further discussions, find us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.